on your computer, and you should really uninstall it. So the problem comes down to when there is a piece of software that you are trying to use, but the software developers who wrote that software have made it dependent upon this ancient, deprecated, security vulnerable software. Unfortunately, then, your only option is to stop using that software and find another approach, because 99.9% of the time when you talk to the software developers, if you can even get to the software developers of that software, they are typically going to say things like, well, we're not going to update that. And you find this really is a big security problem, especially in the Internet of Things space. And I've talked before about this whole topic of IoT devices, where the vast majority of them that are on the market are never designed to be secure to begin with. And then they're not being paid for by the manufacturer of the IoT device to have any sort of a security lifecycle. So there's no plan to maintain them. There's no plan to issue new firmware updates or new security updates for these things. So, I mean, this is why these baby monitors, and a lot of this kind of home user grade surveillance equipment is just never secure from day one. And of course, even if there is a security vulnerability found in it, the manufacturer has no intention and no mechanism by which to deploy a security update for it, because that's never what they paid the software developers to do. So this sort of like outsourced software development really extends even into the financial sector, because I ran into this problem with a product called Deposit Partner, which is issued by Johnson Bank for the ability to scan checks. And their software, according to them, absolutely mandatorily requires Visual Studio C++ 2005 Runtime Edition. And again, I've stated that that software is completely deprecated. It is not patchable by Microsoft. This is a piece of Microsoft software from the year 2005. I mean, you know, no software company can support security patches for software indefinitely. It can't. It's ridiculous. It's a preposterous assumption to think that that's ever going to happen. So an intermediary software developer who makes their software dependent upon another piece of software from another manufacturer, they have to be thinking about that life cycle of that software and say, wow, you know, it's like we've got our software is dependent upon this product that was designed in the year 2005. I'm pretty sure we should have been, you know, rethinking that and republishing a new version of our software maybe 6 years ago. So I have absolutely no sympathy whatsoever for this Deposit Partner software that is currently being utilized by Johnson Bank. And the reason I have no sympathy for it at all is simply because of the fact that it's dependent upon a piece of software that was written in the year 2005. And the developers of Deposit Partner should have been looking into this issue about 6 years ago and saying, we ought to look at the life cycle, the end of support for this Visual Studio C++ 2005 Runtime Edition, and then not make Deposit Partner reliant upon that version. The 2008 version of the C++ Runtime Edition is still supported. It's still patchable. And I ran into this problem literally looking at the traffic and for Visual Studio C++ Runtime Edition, and it was critical. It was vulnerable to a critical highest severity level 5 ransomware A vulnerability. That's a pretty darn big deal. So this is why we must be uninstalling Visual Studio C++ 2005 Runtime Edition from all the computers. And then, of course, the implication is that if you're using an ancient piece of software that is dependent upon that, then you need to find a different alternative. So I did communicate this information over to Johnson Bank, and they've been made aware. I have no reason to believe that they're going to update their software, though. So If you're one of those people who's using Deposit Partner, I suggest that you significantly look into this situation yourself, because you shouldn't be using this 2005 runtime edition anymore. But it's sad. It's very, very sad to me that there's a piece of software out there that is being used in the financial services industry that is dependent upon a fully deprecated and ransomware vulnerable piece of software. So that is the update on the deprecated software topic. Let's now get on to voice over IP services. So I was recently working with a company on the West Coast who signed a contract with a company called 8x8 for a voice over IP call center functionality for 10 people. And coming in to realize what the cost profile of this thing was, it is crazy. It's crazy. It's like $1,500 a month, kind of crazy. And that doesn't even include the software that you need to put on the PCs in order to interface with their service. So $1,500 a month for 10 users to have voice over IP call center capabilities is, wow, very, very, very ridiculously expensive. I mean, that's just crazy. The full retail price of, you know, Skype for Business PSTN calling is $20 a month per user. So, gee, that's $200. There's a pretty significant difference between $1,500 and $20 a month. And even if your call center needed an 800 number, you know, what is that going to put you up at $250 a month? Ooh. Still, again, astronomical price difference, and there's no software fee for Skype for Business with PSTN calling. As a result, this is why so many organizations are going to that service. I mean, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is converting to Skype for Business with PSTN calling. Now, they're abandoning on-premise, you know, SIP lines and PRI circuits and on-premise phone systems. I think the era of the on-premise phone system is dead, because clearly, even for enormous organizations, the cost profile of a service is less expensive than a capital expenditure investment. And this is kind of surprising, because in most cases, when you're talking about subscribing to a monthly fee service that scales at the number of users that you have, in many cases, that is just going to be financial unobtainium, because at some point, it is more cost effective for you to host your own infrastructure. So it's really interesting that looking at the scale of UW-Milwaukee, that it's more cost effective. And so that would suggest that, gee, it's probably more cost effective for pretty much everybody. So I'm hoping to see some more kind of common sense provisions going into place there, because there's so many companies out there that are running these old, dead, ancient phone systems. I mean, I see 12, 16-year-old phone systems all the time, and they're not under warranty. There's no support plan for those things, and companies are running business-critical phone services across those things. And you have to wonder if this phone system is business critical to your organization. What's going to happen if it has a hardware problem? What's going to happen if it has a software problem? Who do you call? There's no support contract for a 12, 16, 20-year-old phone system, but yet I still see organizations running those things. So time to think about getting off of that and, you know, onto something viable. Now, I saw a really interesting article talking about how the TSA is now searching phones and laptops, even on domestic flights. So this is a big change from what we've heard about in the past. I mean, in the last 6 months, we know that the Customs and Border Patrol has been literally just, they'll take your phone, they'll take your laptop, and they'll take it into a private room, and they will effectively download the whole device. And if you do not unlock that device for them so that they can make a full bulk copy of it to do a full search and seizure on you, then you just may never see that device again. So at that point in time, I provided a link to the Customs and Border Patrol actual documentation that stated what they were going to do and what their policy was. And I was suggesting at that time that you probably, if you're going to be traveling internationally, you should be taking a disposable phone with you that has no content on it. And then when you get to your place of destination, then it would make sense for you to, you know, light that phone up with your content afterwards. And the way you light it up with your content after you're at your destination is by logging into your services after the fact. So literally, I'm suggesting travel with a blank device. And because, you know, if it's it, to me, it's just it's a constitutional violation. That's not the way that they see it, but that is certainly the way that I see it. Now, this whole thing with the TSA accused of searching phones now even on and laptops on domestic flights. So this is, let's say you're flying from Florida to California. There are people that have encountered TSA taking their devices for, again, bulk copy, absolutely bulk copy. And they are doing it under this guise of saying, oh, well, you know, you could have an iPad and it could be a bomb. Well, the reality is that it has been a policy in place for a very long time that you had to prove that your device was actually a device that could boot up. Because an iPad is not going to have a bomb in it if it is a device that can be booted up. That if it can be proven that the space inside this iPad is being used for the electronics that run the OS and run the device itself. And they can put these devices through, you know, the sniffing equipment that sniffs for explosive residue, and they can x-ray these devices, and they do. And I would think that between all of those factors, they should be able to figure out that, yeah, it's not a bomb. You don't need to be making a bulk copy of someone's electronics and engaging in a Fourth Amendment search just to prove that the device does not contain a bomb. I mean, those two things are clearly disconnected. There's no relationship between them at all. So I wanted you all to be aware that that is going on, and the ACLU is involved in a lawsuit against the TSA right now. Of course, this is going to go on forever, as they always do, and the game playing of not wanting to release the FOIA documents to the ACLU is going to go on. So, you know, TSA is playing games again, violating rights. That's what they do. Now, back onto this whole voice over IP topic, I wanted to talk about one of the biggest problems with a lot of these VoIP providers and these SIP providers is that they do not publish an up-to-date document on their website that has a link that shows what their IP ranges are or what their FQDNs, fully qualified domain names, are for their services. And with regards to this 8x8 product, what I found is that they also had programmed their stuff to do crazy things, such as ping foreign countries. So if you're a United States customer and you're subscribing to 8x8, there's no reason for your equipment at your U.S. domestic facility to be communicating with resources in foreign countries. But yet, this is the type of functionality that 8x8 wants, which I find to be preposterous. And of course, those things should be blocked by GOIP blocking. It should have nothing to do with the service delivery of voice over IP services in domestic United States. Right? Your 8x8 software that's on your PC should not be talking to stuff in Malaysia. It's just preposterous. It's ridiculous. I mean, voice over IP needs to be optimized so that it doesn't have latency to begin with. If it has latency, then you have voice loss. So you have people with a perception that You don't have call quality because they can't hear the other party effectively. So there's that kind of weird, funny business going on with that. But I also saw in the 8x8 product that it was engaging in a lot of communications with things strictly based upon an IP address. So what this means to me when I analyze the traffic coming out of their software is that their software is very poorly written, because all software should be written and all devices should be written to communicate exclusively with FQDNs, with fully qualified domain names. And so, for example, an FQDN is a host.network.com, right? So it's a name. An FQDN, a fully qualified domain name, is a name. It's not an IP address. So the problem that happens is if you have a piece of software or you have an appliance that's trying to communicate securely with something that's strictly on an IP address, the problem that we have is it's now initiating this HTTPS session over SSL, some flavor of TLS encryption going on there. It's initiating this session over HTTPS to an IP address, which fundamentally is never going to, it's just not going to work from a certificate perspective. All certificates are based upon a name. So that name is, let's see, host.network.com, for example. So in order for your computer or a piece of software or an appliance to talk securely with the web server or the device that is on the that is the recipient of that traffic that is going to host.network.com, two things have to occur. First of all, that device that your computer or its software or your appliance is talking to has to actually have a certificate on it that says, I am host.network.com. And then, of course, the software that tries to communicate to it, that software that's on your PC, must try to communicate and connect with host.network.com. So this way, there is a match on both ends of that secure communication. The PC software is trying to communicate with host.network.com, and then the server that it's communicating to is communicating and saying, I am host.network.com. So therefore, when you talk to me, I will tell you what my certificate is. You can validate using the public key infrastructure that my certificate is accurate and correct and current, not expired, not deprecated, not revoked. Therefore, now we can have this secure communications channel. So in the most brief description of how this works, the software on the PC has to actually be talking to a name, and then that device that is that name must have a certificate that matches that name, and then they can negotiate the secure communication. So, of course, voice over IP traffic should be encapsulated in a secure TLS tunnel, because otherwise, then this traffic can be sniffed and intercepted and these sorts of things. So a good voice over IP provider will try to have this traffic go over a secure TLS tunnel. So it will try to create this HTTPS secure TLS tunnel first and then shove the SIP traffic across it. So fundamentally, though, you know that this process is not going to actually work securely if the makers of the software have been stupid about what they've done. And that stupidity comes in when they craft that software such that it does not talk to a name, but instead it's hard-coded to some IP addresses. Now, that's stupid on two levels. First of all, it doesn't actually allow that security channel to work the way that it's intended to. And the second reason that whole thing is stupid is this element of the fact that the backend infrastructure cannot change if the software has been hard-coded to some IP addresses. What happens when those IP addresses need to change? Well, now you've got a problem. Basically, that functionality is broken because those IP addresses had to change. So when I evaluate voice over IP providers, this is one of the things that I'm looking at, is do they seem to, you know what they're doing? And in the case of 8x8, I mean, I don't really care how big the company is. It seems to me that their infrastructure is not set up correctly. Their testing tools are not set up correctly as far as I'm concerned. So I would recommend that all of the poor voice over IP providers out there and all the poor SIP providers actually take a look at what Microsoft is doing. I mean, first off, they don't do any crazy traffic. All their software is written to use FQDNs. Nothing is written hard-coded to IP addresses. And Microsoft also maintains an active website, multiple websites, where they post an active list of all the FQDNs, including wildcarded FQDNs, and IP ranges. So they give you all the information. They're only giving you the IP ranges of their services if that was something that you wanted to utilize that information in some security rules. They're not giving you those IP ranges because you have to include those in order to make their stuff work, because that's not the case. All of Microsoft's stuff is written to communicate with a fully qualified domain name, not hard-coded to IP addresses. So in order to get 8x8 services to work, I had to not only add wildcarded FQDNs, but also add IP ranges. Because when I inspected the traffic coming from their products, it was hard-coded to IP addresses. You can actually see the traffic where it'll say an HTTPS packet, and it'll have the canonical name, the CN, is blank. And then it will have the server name identifier blank also, so the SNI. So the CN and the SNI are blank. Well, when they're blank, and when you see that traffic just going to an IP address, what that is telling you is that the request from the software to the server on the internet was done with no fully qualified domain name as part of it. So that's a pretty interesting thing that has come up lately with regards to this whole development of the voice over IP stuff. And I keep talking about the voice over IP things because it seems like 2018 is now going to be the year of the voice over IP transition, where a lot of people's old dead phone systems are just, well, they're dying, and you got to get off of them. And local phone services are not cost effective. It's, you know, I understand that a lot of people are paying $60 per month per phone line with Spectrum. And AT&T's UVerse is a weird product, to say the least. It's not a phone service I would want to have. So let's move on and finish up the show here with this, the latest interesting things coming out of Amazon. They have a patent that admits that it will listen in real time for trigger words. And these trigger words could be used to get you arrested and imprisoned because they're going to send this data to third parties for analysis. So you know, this is basically the same sort of problem associated with using anything that you don't have Fourth Amendment protections over. If you're going to just willingly put a spy device into your home, then, you know, you have to deal with the implications of that. And you could be sitting there saying, oh, well, you know, I'm never, you know, I'm not going to be doing any trigger words that are going to get reported. And it's like, I would call baloney on that, because you can't go a single day without finding another incident that's been reported on where somebody's been, you know, falsely accused, falsely arrested, falsely something because of this data access that has been improperly accessed. There are an abundant quantity of ways in which law enforcement can legitimately and legally access data for an investigation when they have legitimate probable cause. And that's really what it comes down to is, do they have legitimate probable cause and can they get a warrant? The problem is when you just bulk fork up this data, then now whoever it is, whether it's law enforcement or another third party, whoever, can go on a fishing expedition. So this technology by Amazon is called Keyword Determinations from Conversational Data. So this conversational data is, it is an algorithm that is designed to analyze at the server side the results of all of this voice data that is being uploaded to them. Now, if you think about Siri in an iPhone or Cortana on a Windows computer, you think about any of these things, and Alexa, of course, Amazon's Alexa, the only way in which these devices can function when you say Alexa, you know, or Siri, it obviously must be listening to you all the time. And it's not listening for your voice, it's listening for the voice recognition of that keyword, and that is strictly just a trigger for it to then interact with you. You must understand that it's actually listening to all of the conversational data all the time. And it is sending that data back to servers, and it's supposed to be for the guise of voice recognition, analysis, improvement, and such, but it's obviously being recorded. It's obviously being sent back to servers. So this latest patent from Amazon is a full admission that they're listening in real time for trigger words, and they're analyzing on these. And what they're doing with it, it says the more words that they collect about you, the more the company gets to know you. And then they will be able to use your private conversations for their financial gain. So Amazon wants to know how many times you're flushing the toilet, how many times you have sex, what you teach your children, when you go on vacation, what are your political views. The more words they collect about you, the more they can predict your purchasing habits, the places you frequent, your medical concerns, the firearms you possess, what is your vaccination status, who you associate with, the causes you support. And this patent reveals that your data could be used to target, market to your friends, family, and so forth when they are looking to purchase gifts for you as well. So this is not innocuous at all, not in the least bit. I see nothing innocuous about this. And this is just an extension of a prior story about why would you buy an Alexa and why would you buy the Amazon time clock where they want this thing to be the alarm in your bedroom and it's stated to have a front-facing camera. So why would you put a device in your bedroom that has a camera and a microphone? Why would you do this? You know, it's, you know, think about the implications of these things. Don't just get sucked into this, like, oh, it's convenient and I can talk to it and, you know, it's convenient and friendly. Well, think about these things a little bit more deeply before you buy these Trojan spy devices and put them in your home.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.